This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The mitzvah we're dealing with this evening, you'll remember at the last year, 2 weeks ago, we introduced the concept of sacrifices. We weren't dealing with a specific mitzvah then, but just since the fourth mitzvah that we're discussing, that's right, is the fourth. Is the sacrifice of the Korban Pesach, of the Pesach sacrifice. It was necessary first for us to do some kind of introduction as to the meaning of sacrifices, the role of sacrifices, and have some kind of sense as to why they form so important a part of Torah, which we did 2 weeks ago. And now we get into the fourth mitzvah. It's not only the fourth mitzvah, it's the fourth, fifth, sixth, I think possibly seventh mitzvah. It entails a number of different mitzvahs all included in the Pesach sacrifice. There is the mitzvah of slaughtering the Pesach sacrifice, there is the mitzvah of eating the Pesach sacrifice, there is the mitzvah of not eating it raw or cooked, there is the mitzvah of eating it roasted, and there are five different mitzvahs, and there are a few more, not breaking bones. There are probably six or seven or maybe even more mitzvahs, all wrapped up in this one action and this one activity, the sacrifice that we bring, used to bring, will bring one day again, the day before Pesach, and we eat at the Seder. As with all of these mitzvahs, there are pages and pages, sometimes chapters and sometimes entire tractates on one mitzvah, so we could busy ourselves for months and months and months on one mitzvah, and it becomes necessary to select and to try and access one key principle or a few key principles and draw a life principle. You remember we're talking about the series as a series of 613 life principles, not just a recounting of the mitzvah. And that's part of the challenge, to find in each of these mitzvahs what are some of the key principles that we can use to give us a new insight, a new way of looking at the world, a new way of understanding the world, that enables us to use it as a life principle. In the case of the Korban Pesach, the aspect that I want to focus on is a strange requirement. Listen to what the Torah says. Not only are we told how to slaughter it and what it is, it's got to be a lamb, and how you've got to slaughter it and how you prepare it and how you eat it, all the normal laws that I understand, that we're given a specific law that we don't find in any other case, where there's a certain quality that has to be present while we're eating it. V'chacha tzeichluo, says the Torah. This is how you must eat it. And this is the great Korban Pesach. We're sitting down at our Seder. And this is how you must eat the Korban Pesach. Certainly that Pesach night, the very first Pesach night. How do you do it? How do you eat? Mosnechem chagurim. Have your belts on and fastened. Ma'alechem beraglechem. Have your walking shoes on. U'makelchem biyedchem. And your walking sticks, your staffs in your hands. Va'achaltem oso bechipozen. And eat it in a rush. Hurry. And so there's this picture, if you can imagine, the people sitting with their coats on, ready, their sticks, everything, ready to go. And they eat their Korban Pesach. You see, we're not allowed to eat on the go. The kind of eating that one finds is becoming increasingly popular is prohibited according to Jewish law. We're not allowed to eat ice creams as we walk in the street, and eat falafel as we walk in the street, and spit out garinim as we walk in the street, and chew gum even when we're not walking in the street. It's just not considered dignified. And therefore we're in a rush, and where is the thing that people normally do when they're in a rush is take something to eat and eat it in the car, eat it while they're traveling. No, we're not eating it while we're traveling. Eating it before we start the travel, but immediately before, ready to go, so that you can eat it and go. And there's got to be chipozon, there's got to be speed in the eating, which is contrary to the way we normally eat, it's contrary to the way we normally do things, but there's a requirement of speed. This is one of the few mitzvahs where there's a requirement of speed, and that requirement is key to the whole of Pesach. Because after all, that's what matzah is. Matzah is bread baked with speed. Matzah is the same ingredients as bread plus an extra ingredient, and that is extreme speed. And if you go to a matzah factory, you sense that speed, you feel the speed. There's an enormous urgency because there's a very short time frame that is permitted from the time the water touches the flour until the time the matzah has to be fully baked at the other end. That's 18 minutes. And when you're doing a fast production, when you're doing a large production of matzah, with lots of people, lots of workers, and particularly when you're doing a hand production of matzah, with machine production, you don't feel the panic quite as much because the machines are just set up to do things at that speed. But when you're dealing with a handmade operation, the sense of urgency and of speed is very, very palpable. There's an urgency in Pesach, there's a speed. That's what matzah is. Matzah is bread baked in a hurry. Bread baked with speed. That's what matzah is. And what I want to look at briefly this evening is the meaning of this quality of speed in the introduction of this particular mitzvah. The second theme is a phrase that is used. We have it in the Haggadah as well, and it comes from Tehillim, where King David says, "O hanisa Elokim lavoy lo kachas lo goy mikerev goy." Has God ever again tried to do what he did at the coming out of Egypt, taking a nation out from within another nation? Very interesting image of what Yetzias Mitzrayim was, taking a nation out from within another nation. And the Medrash on Tehillim says, "Omer Rabbi Abba Bar Acha b'shem Rabbi Chanin." Mahu goy mikerev goy. What is this image? Taking one nation out from the midst of another nation, from inside another nation. Ke odom sheshomet es haubar mimei behema. Like a person pulling out an animal from that is being born from the inside of its mother. Kach hoitzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu es Yisrael mimitzrayim. That's how God took us out of Egypt. So the image here of taking one nation out from another is like the image of taking the baby out of the mother's womb. That there was like a gestation period in Egypt in which we were insulated and enveloped by the womb, and the womb was Egypt. And God takes us out. And it's interesting there too that in the image of birth there is also an element of speed. But in the image of birth, firstly, there is a moment of transformation from fetus to baby. One moment it's a fetus, the next moment it's a baby, although there's a period leading up to that, but there's a moment of birth. There's not an evolution of birth. Birth is not an evolutionary process. Birth is an instantaneous process, so there's a sense of speed, of instantaneousness there. But also there's a sense of urgency, there's a window of opportunity. If the birth is not completed in a relatively short period of time, the baby can be endangered or the mother can be endangered. So there's a sense of urgency, there's a sense of birth, there's a sense of speed in the process of birth as well. Now, I was considering speed this evening, and in my very amateurish way, which has nothing to do with physics, but just trying to understand it a little bit, I came to an astonishing conclusion, which isn't right from a physics point of view, but is, I think, right mathematically. And that is, just reason about with me for a moment. And I'm going to use this to explain an idea that I started developing in shul a week or two ago, where we spoke about the difference between constant movement and being in a place of stillness, what the nature of that place of stillness is. Here's the logic I was trying to work out. If point A and B are separated by a mile of distance, and it takes me an hour to go from A to B, and I'm traveling at 1 mile an hour. If I travel 1 mile an hour, it will take me an hour to get from A to B. If I travel 10 times as fast, it will take me 6 minutes. It will take me a tenth of an hour to get from A to B. If I travel 100 times as fast, it will take me 1/100th of an hour. 1,000 times as fast, it will take me 1,000th of an hour. 1,000,000 times as fast, it will take me 1,000,000th of an hour. Leave aside the physical limitation that we can't go faster than light. That's just physics. Think of the maths of it. what's happening, as I move faster and faster, the time it takes me to get from A to B becomes less and less.
That's simple enough.
What happens when I hit infinite speed? It must take me zero time. Isn't that so? Which means I am simultaneously in point A and point B. You can't do what? Don't spoil one. But from a calculus point of view, you must approach zero as you approach infinity. Which means that you're approaching a point of being stationary the faster you go. The intuitive thing is, the faster you go, the less stationary you are. Stationary is absence of speed. But what I was playing with this evening was, the opposite could be true as well. You could be stationary because you are going at an infinite speed. Or you could be close to stationary, because if it takes zero time to get from A to B, then you must be at A and B at the same time, which means you must be stationary. Which means there are two different concepts of stationary. You can be stationary because you're not moving, and you can be stationary because you are moving so fast that you encompass everything. That there's no time in movement from A to B. Movement can actually transcend speed and distance, is the concept I was playing with. Now, why that's also important is because the kind of speed we're looking at here, if you look at sometimes defining a moment, let's say the moment that the Jewish people transformed from being a band of slaves into a sophisticated nation, and look how sophisticated they were. They became a nation in moments that gave the world almost everything of value that it has today. By the time we got to Sinai already, 49 days later, the Torah was already in the world. And we didn't just develop that at 49 days. We were born as a nation in a moment. From what? From nothing. We were a band of slaves. So when we look at a transformational moment, there is radical movement. Look at the movement from fetus to child. If you analyze the physiology of the fetus as opposed to the physiology of the child, you won't notice much difference. Analyze the baby a moment before birth and a moment after birth, and it's the same chemical substance, same measurements, not much different. But behaviorally, it's vastly different. The way it functions is vastly different. It's two different beings. The one is a human being, capable of human interaction already at some level, already at that moment, and the other is not a human being, not capable of any human interaction. The one is completely dependent on the mother and plays no part even in something so primitive as eating. And the other digests its own food already, in an instant. So the time it takes to travel from fetus to baby, which is much further than from New York to Los Angeles, much further than from Los Angeles to Tokyo, much further than from Earth to Moon, if you look at that as a distance, at the change that takes place in that moment, the time that it takes is zero. Does that mean because there's no movement? No, that means because there's a different quality of movement. There is a movement that is, and we'll define that movement a little bit clearer in a moment or two. There is a movement that is so fast, so energetic, so explosive, that it is instantaneous. Some things mature in a linear fashion. Things have to be done in a certain order. First the foundation has to be laid, and then another level, and then another level. That's how some change takes place. If you want to build a house, that's how you build a house. You want to mature, you want to produce a fine bottle of wine, you cannot accelerate it. There's a way to do it. You have to grow the grapes, you have to harvest the grapes, you have to make the wine, you have to let the wine stand. You cannot accelerate it. There needs to be linear time in the process. And that's the symbol of chometz. Chometz is the process that goes into the baking of the bread. Matzah is the concept of instantaneous change. Again, matzah compared to flour. Take flour, you take water. You put it together, and in a relative instant, you've got matzah. put a bit of heat into it. It's something completely different. This isn't a linear change. This is an exponential change that takes place in one explosive instant, almost. And not almost, it really is so. Because there's a moment in the preparation process where it changes from dough to matzah. Once it's matzah, it cannot become chometz. So if you take it out of the oven a moment too soon, then a moment or two later it becomes chometz. Or if you put water on it, it will become chometz. If you take it out of the oven a moment or two later, it will never become chometz. It's now matzah. What separated the matzah from the chometz? A moment. One moment. What is the difference between matzah and chometz? The difference is if you eat matzah on Pesach, you get Olam Haba. And if you eat chometz on Pesach, you get Kores. Your soul can be destroyed. That's the difference. So how far is that distance between the destruction of a soul and the achievement of Olam Haba? Is that the distance from Los Angeles to New York? Is that the distance of one culture to another? That's a distance that's almost incomprehensible. And what does it depend on? One moment. One moment it's chometz, the next moment it's matzah. And that creates the transformation. So what I'm suggesting is that although transformation is sometimes prepared by a long process of maturation and gestation, the actual moment of transformation is a moment, literally, it's a second. And the distance traveled in that moment is far greater than the distance in the whole maturation process. That's what the nature of that change is, the nature of that transformation. And when we were transformed from a band of slaves into a nation, into a sophisticated nation of Klal Yisrael, that was an enormous distance traveled in an instant. And we try and recapture that instant with the Korban Pesach, with the sacrifice of Pesach, and with the Seder night, with the whole concept of Pesach. When was the moment of birth of national birth? If we consider that for a moment. So let's say we now understand that there was a long period in Egypt. There were 210 years in Egypt, of which 70 of them were in very severe slavery. There was preparation that took place during that time. But at that point, it was before birth, where this was the process of gestation. So what did that mean? And what did the birth mean? The Gemara says, Lama havlad doime b'nei ima. The Gemara says in Nida, what is a fetus like in its mother's womb? And describes what the fetus is like and how it lies. Ufiv sosum v'tibura posuach, says the Gemara. The fetus's mouth is closed and his belly button is open. That's how he's fed. If he opens his mouth, he can die. If he closes his belly button, he can die. It's important for the fetus that the mouth stays closed and the belly button stays open. The mother does the digesting. The fetus doesn't even have to do the digesting. And at the moment of birth, if the belly button stays open, the baby can die. If the mouth doesn't open, the baby can die. So in an instant, what was sealed has to open, and what was open has to seal. There has to be a complete opposite, and the child starts functioning on its own. How does that compare to the image of the Jewish people in Egypt? What that Gemara would then say, when the Medrash says that we were like taking us out of a nation from within a nation, that would imply that we were as dependent for our nourishment on Egypt as a fetus is on its mother. But we were not digesting anything, and we didn't have digestive capability. Digestive capability is one of the most important things that we have, because with digestion we can take in a variety of different sources of nourishment, and we can sort it out. We can reject that which has to be rejected. We can pull out the good qualities that we need from the particular things. We can enjoy the contrast that the different things have. If we don't have the digestive quality, if we didn't have a digestive capability, we would have to be fed a tasteless mush that was only full of nourishment. The fact that we can digest allows us variety, pleasure, because we have the capacity to distinguish and to separate. And the difference between what we were in Egypt and what we were after Egypt, after we left Egypt, was our own capacity to process knowledge and information, to digest knowledge and information, to be able to take in knowledge, sort it out, reject that which is wasteful or that which is negative, integrate that which is true, make it part of ourselves and absorb it as part of ourselves. I spoke in Shul on Shabbos about the difference between, and Mr. McGillnick was kind enough to tell me afterwards that the word that I was using there is actually a computer phrase. The difference between pinging an emotion and reciprocating. That ping, like as in ping pong, and Mr. McGillnick told me that in computeries, when you send a signal out from one computer to another and just measure the time it takes, make sure that it gets there, comes back, how quickly does it take to get, that's called pinging. And we talked about how people ping instead of reciprocate. Now I give you, you give me. How are you? Fine, thanks. And you? Fine, thanks. Now we think we've had a relationship. We've actually engaged in something. It's nothing. We've pinged at each other. And we talked about that a little bit in shows, because there's no digestion taking place in that. Digestion is, there's a difference between digesting something and pinging it. Pinging is that you take it into your mouth and you spit it out again. Chewing gum, that's pinging. Put it in, chew, spit it out. That's pinging. But to take food in and to absorb it and to enjoy it and then to have the body start sorting it out. I need this, I don't need that. I need this first and then I need that. I need this in this part of my body and I need that in that part of my body. This isn't good for me at all. I must get rid of it real quick. That's what the digestive process does. And exactly as our digestive system operates, so does our mental and our spiritual digestive system. With that, we can take in things from the world. We can take in ideas from the world. And we can sort them out. We can afford not to be dogmatic. We can afford not to be narrow. We can afford not to be limited, because we know how to digest. And when we do hear a good idea, we don't just quote the good idea back again. Because that's not digestion. That's not a digestive system. A person is filled with quotes and can tell you what this book says and what this rabbi says and what this encyclopedia says. That's not a digestive process. That's a pinging process. That's not an absorption process. When we were in Egypt, we had no way of absorbing. So we were dependent for our nourishment on Egypt. We were a nation being nourished by Egyptian culture. That's what the shibud was. That was the slavery. We weren't being nourished by our own culture, or not even our own. We weren't being nourished by our own capacity to digest whatever we took in and make it our own. If you don't have a digestive system, you can make nothing your own. So nothing that you've got is authentic. Everything that you've got is borrowed. Everything that you've got is duplicated. It's taken from somewhere else. It's not yours. That's the fetus. Nothing belongs to the fetus. Even its food comes from elsewhere and is pre-digested. When the birth takes place, the baby takes over. Now the baby can eat and the body starts performing the function of digestion. At what moment did the Jewish people develop their digestive capacity? Let's try and define the moment of birth. If we're talking about the birth of a nation, what was the moment of that birth? Because other nations aren't born. Other nations evolve. I can't think of a nation that was born. Nations evolve over a period of time, and then their culture evolves, and their language evolves, and their philosophy evolves, and then they develop a legal system. That didn't happen with us. In an instant, we had a language, we had a legal system, we had a culture, we had a religion, we had a philosophy. In an instant, we were born, we didn't evolve. We were created. It was a moment of birth. When was the moment? What transformed us from a fetus dependent on the culture of our environment to an independent nation capable of self-digestion of ideas and of thoughts and of concepts? The moment was the sacrificing of the Korban Pesach. Because quite apart from all the other aspects of sacrifice that we learned last time, the important thing about the Korban Pesach is, what did they sacrifice? They sacrificed a sheep. They sacrificed a lamb. And a lamb was the Egyptian god. How does a nation of slaves take the god of its masters and slaughter it? And not only slaughter it for 5 days before that, they had to keep the animals bound up. They had to find the right animal and capture the animal and then keep the animal for 5 days. And the Egyptians would come and say, what are you doing with these lambs? These are our gods. And the Jews would have to say, well, we're actually going to be slaughtering them in 5 days' time. A nation of slaves saying that to their masters? Because of the Korban Pesach that we so fiercely reject the idea that it took 40 years for the nation to redeem itself from slavery, to get rid of its slavery mentality. This was birth. Didn't have to get rid of it. When a baby is born, it doesn't take weeks or months or even minutes to get rid of its fetus mentality. The moment it's born, it's different. When the nation was born, it was no longer a slave. There was no longer slavery. When the nation was born, it had no more slavery characteristics. There was a moment, if it had slavery characteristics, it would never have been able to do that, to have had the courage to take the God of the Egyptians and slaughter it and feel quite fine about it, and be able to stand up to that, when they had no way of protecting themselves against the Egyptians. That's the test of whether we are a fetus living in the womb of another nation, or we are independent. Here, Jews living in the United States, what are we? Are we self-digesting beings capable of developing our own ideas, living as an independent nation, or are we a fetus living in the womb? The test is, can we sacrifice the gods that aren't ours? Or are we bound by them? Are we limited by them? And you can think of probably many of the gods of the society in which we live. And one has to question, to what extent are we willing, or would we be willing, to reject those norms if they're not norms that conform with the Torah. I had occasion today to speak to a group of lawyers and legal professionals about the enormously destructive impact of political correctness in the United States. It's one of the gods. It's one of the gods of the United States. It's a destructive god, like any idol is. Are we willing to put that aside and to say what's right and to say what's true and to defend that and to argue that and to stand by that? Or do we navigate through the ways of political correctness because we are still governed by that? We're a fetus in a mother's womb, and a fetus doesn't challenge its mother. It's just accept, it just takes, it feels grateful to be there, and that's it. That's how it lives and that's how it operates. And those are some of the things that one has to look at. To what extent, it's not just a question of American norms, it's Western norms, it's norms of the society in which we live in a much more global sense. To what extent are we willing to question, to examine, and if necessary to sacrifice on the altar of truth any god of our society that is false? That is the test of whether we are a nation that has transcended its environment, or we are a nation insulated by its environment. Because that's the difference between independence and birth and dependence. We have to ask that of the state of Israel itself. To what extent is the state of Israel able to do that? To what extent is it able to stand by its own principles and to do what it believes is right? And to what extent is it nourished by other sources to an extent that it doesn't have an independent existence? And one has to ask that philosophically, and one has to ask that politically, and one has to ask that militarily. To what extent, when one walks the streets of Tel Aviv, leave Yerushalayim aside for a moment, when one walks the streets of Tel Aviv, to what extent is one imbibing Avira Deis Israel? To what extent is one imbibing the culture of the Jewish people? Or is one actually simply breathing in the pre-digested nourishment that the West has pumped in and Israel takes, because it's actually a fetus in a womb, it's not really an independent country? Where do you see the independence? We've got to ask ourselves, question ourselves, challenge it all the time. Do we really see an independently functioning organism capable of developing its own thoughts and its own ideas? It used to be that. It used to be that enormously. That's when there was a strong idealism that came from nowhere, other than from Zionism or from the Torah, wherever that source was. It wasn't from the West. And there was a time when you went to Israel, you didn't feel you were in America. You knew very well you were somewhere very different. And that required adjustment and adaption. Today it's a little bit different, and it's in that way politically, and it's that way militarily. There was a time when the country felt courageous and free enough to do what it thought was right and deal with the consequences later. Today we're seeing that it's unable to do that. Why? Because perhaps in reality we're not independent enough. We are still an ubar bima'ei imo. We're still a fetus nourished by a mother, but we're unable to draw away from. Our birth has not yet taken place. There hasn't been a complete birth. We're still a fetus, possibly. We talk about that transcending an environment, and in fact, if you look at the image of height, that gives us one more sense of understanding of speed, of infinite speed leading to a stationary situation. Because, of course, if you can imagine a point above the ground and an angle, say a 45 degree angle from that point, that covers a certain amount of space on the ground. As you move higher, that covers more and more space. And if you move to infinite height, it will cover infinite space, ultimately. So height, in fact, allows simultaneous absorption of a wide area of space, even from a vision point of view. If you're down here, you can see a certain field of vision. If you're in an aeroplane, looking with that same eye, that same glass, you can see tens of miles. If you're out in outer space, you can see the whole world in one go. What height gives is the capacity to instantly and simultaneously perceive wide distances, very, very big distances, and to be able to absorb them in one moment of vision. And that's the element of height. So when we talk about a kind of speed that allows one to be in two places at once, what we're talking is not about speed from point A to point B. We're talking about introducing a third dimension to speed. But if there's also an element of height, then you're able to be in two places at the same time. There's not a contradiction. If I want to say, look at New York, and at the same time look at Los Angeles, it's not possible. But it is possible if you're high enough. Sure, it's possible. You won't see the same detail, but you can. You can see them both at the same time if you're high enough. So the capacity to absorb a large spectrum of ideas, of views, of places, of concepts, requires height. The higher you are, the more you can take in. The lower you are, the less you can take in. And see a Kabbalistic idea that the Targum Yonason mentions a little further on in the Torah, in Parshas Yisro, where God says, Atem re'isem asher asisi l'mitzrayim, you saw what I have done to Egypt, vo'esor eschem al kanfei neshorim, and I carried you on eagle's wings, vo'vi eschem eloi, and I brought you to me. The Targum Yonason says the following. Very surreal image it paints, but we now begin to understand some of it. Aton chamison, he says, this is an Aramaic, you've seen ma'di avdis l'mitzrayim, what I did to the Egyptians, Utsaonis Yaschun al Anonin, hey, and I transported you on these clouds of glory, Ka'al Gadfe Nashorim, as if on the wings of an eagle. So we get the image of height, the eagle that soars. So I took you high. This traveling that I'm about to talk about was a height traveling. I took you on the wings of eagles. Min Filusin, I took you from Ramses in Egypt, where you were living. The Ovilis Yaschun La'asar Beis Mukdasha, and I brought you to the place of the Beis Hamikdash, to Jerusalem. Lameva Tamon Pischo, to bring your first Korban Pesach that year. Uvahav Laila, that very same night, a Sivis Yaschun Lefilusin, I returned you to Ramses. Umitamon Kuribis Yaschun Lulfin Oraisa, and from there I took you out and brought you to Sinai to learn the Torah. So what happened that night? Did we really travel from Ramses to Jerusalem and back again? And still brought the Korban Pesach in Jerusalem? A trip that even today we couldn't do in anything like that speed? Is that really what happened? The eagle. You had enough height to be simultaneously in Ramses and Jerusalem. And to be able to bring your Korban with your mind in Jerusalem. And to have your physical being in Ramses. You were able to be in two places at once. Because you had that element of height. So if we come back to that mitzvah of chippozon, the kachat echluison, this is how you should eat the korban. Your belt should be on, your shoes on your feet, your staff in your hand, v'achaltem lo'isa b'chippozon, and eat it in a hurry, eat it in a rush. What are we talking about? We're talking about capturing that sense of speed, but not the speed that comes from running around like crazy, the speed that comes from gaining sufficient altitude to have a perspective that in an instant allows you to transform. But an instant allows you to move from one position to another, to see the one, to see the other, and to be able to transform from one into the other, because from that height, it doesn't look that far. From that height, it doesn't take so long. From that height, it's not a major transformation. And lastly, the Rambam says, commenting in the Moreh Nevuchim on the speed element and why it comes over and over in the Korban Pesach, a few amazing words that one could so easily miss. He says, firstly, Chukim HaMiyuchodim BePesach, all the special statutes of Pesach, that you've got to eat it roasted, and it's got to be eaten in one home, and the bone mustn't be broken. All of these reasons, and it's interesting, if you just look at these two laws, this is not the Rambam that comments on this, but it's so important to see. We're looking at the birth of a nation, and the birth of the nation happens at the moment of the Korban Pesach. In the laws, in the technical laws of the Korban Pesach, are principles that teach us the essence of what a nation and a community is. And just see that for a moment. We learn from the laws of Korban Pesach, the principle that we use all over the Talmud, of Shlucho Shel Adam Kemoisei, one may appoint an agent. One can appoint an agent to perform a deed, even a mitzvah, on one's own behalf. And it's as if one did it oneself, not with all mitzvahs, but with certain mitzvahs. You can appoint an agent to do that. So for example, you can even appoint an agent for marriage. So if you, in the old days, if you wanted to marry a woman who was living in another country, you could appoint a shaliach, who could go there, and he could do the kiddush and stand under the chuppah in your place, give the ring in your place, do the whole thing on your behalf. So the action is as if you did it yourself. Where do we learn that from, that one person can do a mitzvah for another? From Korban Pesach. Because not everybody has to slaughter. The mitzvah is everybody must slaughter a lamb. But the fact is, many people can use one lamb. So what happens to the act of the mitzvah of slaughtering? So they go, well, you see, one person could slaughter a lamb for the whole community, and it's as if each person performed the mitzvah of slaughter. Because Shlucho Shel Adam Kemoisei, he's an agent. He does the mitzvah. The mitzvah is for a father to bris his own son. And according to most authorities, when we appoint a mohel, what are we doing? We're appointing him as an agent. The father, and some mohelim are specific about asking the father to formally appoint him as a shaliach. I'm doing this on your behalf, so it's your mitzvah, not mine. So the father who's doing it, I'm just the agent. And we learn all of that from the Korban Pesach. On the other hand, we learn that the entire nation of Israel could have one Korban, because you're allowed to form groups to have the Korban. So what do we see here? When we're talking about the obligation to slaughter, every individual has to do it. Either physically do it or through an agent. Even if only one lamb is slaughtered for the whole nation, each individual is considered having performed that mitzvah of slaughtering. So when it comes to the obligation, the action, every individual has to do it. When it comes to eating, we can all eat one lamb. The whole nation can be yotzei with one korban. What do we see? It's the opposite of how we often think. When you're looking at community and nation, when you look at the responsibilities, look at the individual. When you look at the benefits, look at the group. There is no benefit to the individual to belong to a community. Other than that, he is part of that community and as such benefits. There is a responsibility of an individual to belong to a community. And the same with nation. Instead of looking at community and nation and saying, what's in it for me? That's not the way to look at it. There's nothing in it for you. There's in it something in it. If you're part of the community, then there's something in it for the community. A community is stronger as a community than a community is without it being a community, obviously. A community benefits from community. And as a member of community, I benefit too, but only as a member. As an individual, it's responsibility. That's what it requires. And we see that in the birth of the nation. On the responsibility side, every individual has to participate. On the benefit side, we get together as a group. The benefits are for the group, the responsibilities are for the individual. And says the Rambam, in all of these laws we see that there's an element of speed. The way the matzah is baked is because of speed. It didn't have time to rise because of speed. We don't have a chance to cook the the Korban Pesach in a normal kind of a way. It has to be roasted. That's the quickest way to prepare it. We're not allowed to break it into pieces and serve it in pieces because there's a speed. We're not allowed to send from one house to another. Everybody has to get together and eat it in the place where it was cooked because there's an element of speed. Why is that? Kedei shelo yisacher echod mehem velo yuchol latzeis. Because at that time the fear was that if anybody wasn't quick enough, they might not have got out of Egypt. The speed was an important part of the process, because without the speed there could have been failure of the exercise for an individual. And what do we see here? That as long as the maturation takes, there is a moment of transformation. And if you miss the moment, it's gone. It's missed. We spoke about that in Shul a little while ago as well. And you miss a moment of a birth. You can't say, well, I'll see it later on, or I'll see it on a video. You won't. You'll see a video, but you won't see the birth. It doesn't happen again. That's the time that it happened. Everything has its moment. And if one doesn't participate in the right moment, the fact that it takes years to develop, and you're watching a slow process, but that moment of transformation that we saw, and we're talking about that instant, if you don't get it, it's gone. And so it's possible, although this was all by miracle, there were so many nisim, there were so many miracles, but one miracle won't happen. That is, the train doesn't wait. God's train doesn't wait. There's a certain process, there's a certain speed, and sometimes things happen in an instant. And if we aren't ready at that instant, to seize that instant, to participate in that instant, to engage and to maximize that instant, we sometimes don't get a second chance. We get other chances to do other things, but that one's gone. And it is feasible, it's conceivable, says the Rambam, an amazing comment. And that's part of what this is there, to teach us that there's a time, no matter that it took 210 years for this to happen, 400 years for this to happen, no matter we knew it was going to happen, you've got to be there at the moment, and you've got to be there quickly, you've got to participate at the right speed, otherwise there's a possibility of losing it altogether. So the Torah warns us in the mitzvah that not only is there a specific object that has to be eaten, but there's a way to eat it. Not only does it have to be prepared in a special way, but there's a special speed at which to eat it. So as to remind us as a nation at all times, that speed, the energy of speed, that enormous energy that takes place when something occurs at that speed was present, that we had to be part of that energy, that we had to share in that energy, that we had to invest the process with that energy from within ourselves, and if we weren't fast enough, we could miss it. And so it is with our lives. We need to understand that at times, there are some things take a long time to develop and to mature, but there are situations that occur in a moment and in an instant, and it's necessary for us to be there in order to participate in that particular experience. That's the chipozen, that is the speed element and the speed dimension of the mitzvah of Korban Pesach, the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th mitzvah of the Torah. Next week, by the way, there will be a shiur, and then we're going to take a break until January, until after New Year. So there will be one more shiur in the series this year, and that's next Monday night, and thereafter we'll break. Thank you.